From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, I speak with anti-apartheid activist Randall Robinson. As executive director of the group Trans Africa, Robinson is one of the main figures responsible for making apartheid an issue in America. Also today, I talk with novelist Elmore Leonard. His new novel, Touch, is a departure from the crime novels that made Leonard popular. Rock historian Ed Ward explains how Chuck Berry came to write a song about a woman named Maybelline. And book critic John Leonard reviews two novels by young authors, Jill Eisenstadt's From Rockaway and Bret Easton Ellis's The Rules of Attraction. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. My guest is Randall Robinson, one of the key figures in the American campaign against apartheid in South Africa. In 1984 and 85, he led a series of daily sit-ins outside the South African embassy in Washington, D.C., protesting apartheid. Approximately 3,600 people were arrested during that year of demonstrations, including tennis star Arthur Ashe, first daughter Amy Carter, 23 members of Congress, including Senator Lowell Weicker, and several mayors. Robinson is the national coordinator of the Free South Africa movement. He's also the founding executive director of Trans Africa, a lobbying group which focuses on African and Caribbean issues. Robinson grew up in Richmond, Virginia, while it was still segregated. The first integrated school he attended was Harvard Law School. Earlier today in Philadelphia, he addressed a conference on the black perspective on the Constitution's bicentennial at Drexel University. Randall Robinson, I want to welcome you to Fresh Air.
Well, thank you.
Let's start with your first trip to South Africa. Now, this was in December 76. You went, I believe, with a congressional delegation. I'm sure you had braced yourself to be in the country of apartheid, but what were you unprepared for when you landed there?
Well, that one can intellectually prepare, but you can't emotionally prepare. And I was surprised to learn how much emotionally I had healed from my own experience in the American South, and how so much of that pain was renewed during my stay in South Africa. It was a searing, very biting, hurtful experience. It tore scar tissue off old wounds. I remember one exchange so vividly. We were in the American consulate at Cape Town. The delegation was led by Charles Diggs. We had, I think, one senator in the delegation, Joe Biden. John Anderson, there were seven members of the Congressional Black Caucus in the group. And we were talking to a group of white South African businessmen. And we had talked in a very circular fashion for a long time about nothing of any real consequence. And Congressman Diggs said, I think we ought to get to the core of the issue, the real problem. Here that has to be resolved is the problem of a franchise, and when the white minority will be prepared to give the black majority the right to vote. The whites seemed startled by the question and went through some silent process of electing the one who would answer the question, as if Congressman Diggs had uttered some heresy. And then he gave an answer, all the more shocking because it was given without malice. He said to put a vote in the hands of blacks would be like giving guns to five-year-olds. And then we were shocked. And I thought my childhood had insulated me from shock.
I guess it was not only the statement, but his ease in saying
the
it
ease
that
in
was
saying
so shocking.
He seemed to be, they seemed to be dumbfounded by such a question, so cut off from the rest of the world, so cut off from civilized and organized humanity in their own bestial social practices that they They simply seemed never to have contemplated transfer of power of that kind. We went into the next room to show you how the ships pass in the South African night. Went into the next room and listened to a young South African minister in a discussion that began a friendship that has lasted for 11 years, who spelled out in graphic terms with great courage, because he had to have known that the South Africans would have access to what he was telling us, spelled out in some great detail the nuts and bolts of apartheid and what would be required to change that awful system. His name was Alan Bosak, and he's come to be one of the great leaders in the struggle there. As a matter of fact, I shared a Sunday platform at Bright Hope Baptist Church here on Sunday as Reverend Bosak spoke at Congressman William Gray's church here in Philadelphia. But we left there later that day to go to the airport. Perhaps the story here is even more remarkable, even more tragic. We went to the airport. Our plane, one of these United States of America planes, was commanded by Colonel John Farr, a black a colonel. And, of course, it was staffed by U.S. Air Force personnel. Airmen were the cooks, and we had a black State Department doctor on board. I think this kind of command and this kind of delegation was a little known about in South Africa. It sort of shocked their senses. And I recall going to the gate with the delegation behind Colonel Farr to see if the plane had been serviced and was ready to depart to Freetown, Sierra Leone. And Colonel Farr asked the white airport supervisor if the plane was ready. And he got no answer, nothing. He said, I'm Colonel Farr. I'm in command of this United States aircraft. Is the plane prepared? Has it been serviced and fueled? And is it ready to depart? No answer. For the airport official could not arrange his thoughts to contemplate, to accept that this black American was in command of a United States of America aircraft. And so he looked past Colonel Farr and addressed his comment to a steward, a cook, an airman, a 19-year-old child of the lowest rank in the Air Force behind Colonel Farr. And he said, sir, the plane is ready. Of course, the child was embarrassed. it was an unbelievable situation, and Congressman Charles Rangel said, I don't think you know what you're doing, and to avoid an international incident, you'd better clear away and make this plane ready so we can depart.
So a lot of people have been appalled at circumstances that they've witnessed in other countries. And then they come back home, and slowly the anger wears off, and the problem seems far away, and you readjust to your life at home. This did not happen with you. The anger and the shock stayed with you. Why?
Well, I used to believe when I was a child that as a child with tunnel vision, as we all have, a prisoner of one's hometown, that racism was a phenomenon of the American South. Then I went to Boston to law school, and I discovered it was a bigger problem than I thought. And then I went to live in Africa. And you find how far American private and public sector tentacles reach. I think it's particularly important in the year of the 200-year constitutional celebration that we talk about what the values of the Constitution are to mean to us, and how we would expect our foreign policy to be imbued with some of the liberty and freedom and democracy that we cherish. And oftentimes we find our foreign policy doesn't seem to be influenced at all by it. So when you're in South Africa, you understand clearly what your responsibility as an American is once you come home, because the cars are ours. And when one looks up on the billboards, you see our companies named. When you look at the oil companies, they're our oil company. South Africa has no oil. We give it to it. We refine it. Have no computers. We've computerized the whole thing. So that the Western community, led by the United States, supplies the legs on which this monster stands. So a part of our responsibility, both to them and to ourselves, is to come back and do what we can. Now, that's my responsibility as a human being. That's my responsibility as an American.
As we all know, Black Americans haven't achieved real equality in America. So I think for any politically motivated Black American, there's probably this question of priority, which is going to come first in your political organizing, working at home, or working on issues abroad?
That's a question that's asked all the time. They have to all enjoy equal footing. We're not full-fledged Americans, Americans without asterisks, until we participate in every aspect of this country's business. And that means that we not only have to strive to do that, but Americans have to learn to perceive us in every sector of American activity. We've never had an American Secretary of State. We've never had an Assistant Secretary for Africa. Our numbers are too low in the ambassadorial corps. For too long, there have been barriers not only to Black Americans, but to ethnic hyphenates in this country, and the participation in the foreign policy process. When Martin Luther King spoke out against the Vietnam War, a part of the response to his statement was that he was a civil rights leader. What's he to do with this? And he was thoughtful about it. He was accurate about it. He's been vindicated by history. And yet other religious leaders like Jerry Falwell, who hasn't the faintest notion of what South Africa and other foreign policy issues are about, never been met with such negative reaction. It's because King was Black, and there still is that kind of a discouragement to Black participation in other sectors, thinking that if it's Black, it has to do with civil rights. No, we are not represented adequately in many of the power corridors, in industry, in business, in academia, in media. It's not who's in front of the camera that counts in this business. It's who makes the editorial decisions. It's who's in that editorial room at the New York Times and the Washington Post and AP and UPI and ABC, CBS and NBC. That's where it counts. And we still find ourselves underrepresented in those capacities. So we've got a long way to go. And these things complement each other. Until we're free in South Africa, and I don't mean this in any kind of romantic way, I'm talking about in full control of resources on which the world depends, raw materials and precious minerals and the like, and then we won't come to any full power, because power in the last analysis is rooted in economic capacity.
I want to talk more about your work regarding South Africa, but first we're going to take a short break, and my guest is Randall Robinson. We'll talk more after this break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live from WHYY in Philadelphia and is distributed by National Public Radio.
My guest is Randall Robinson. He's the national coordinator of the Free South African Movement. He's also the founding executive director of Trans Africa, which is a lobbying group that focuses on African and Caribbean issues. Well, we're talking about your trip to South Africa and how you came back and decided to organize around an anti-apartheid campaign.
Sure.
Now, when you came back to America, this is in 1977, there wasn't the same American awareness of apartheid that there is now. When you started talking to Americans about what you witnessed in South Africa, did people really understand what you were talking about?
No, not then. Charles Diggs, at the time, headed the Subcommittee on Africa in the House of Representatives, and we couldn't get a sanctions bill out of his own subcommittee, much less the full committee. Now it has passed, of course, the House and the Senate, and we've overridden the veto of the President of the United States. Of course, Congress doesn't lead. It largely follows public sentiment, and that had to be developed. And it meant that you had to put this issue squarely in the middle of the American public policy agenda, and you had to do it through television. I think the embassy demonstrations with celebrities offering themselves for arrest made this a great American story. And when it became that story, because I've always maintained that if you can put the facts before the American people, that they will decide fairly what our policy ought to be. And that's been demonstrated so far.
Well, you were one of the first people to get arrested. You sat in front of the South African embassy with Mary Frances Berry and with Walter Fauntleroy, and you were all arrested. This was the first demonstration that you held there.
Yes.
That led to the year of sit-ins outside the embassy. Did you think you were going to get arrested?
Well, we virtually knew that. We went into the embassy to have a meeting with Ambassador Faure, and we demanded that the political prisoners in South Africa be released, Nelson Mandela and all of the thousands of others, and that a constitutional convention be convened and progress began towards a democratization in that country, and that we weren't going to leave the embassy until the South African government had made a firm commitment. He left the room for about a half hour, presumably to consult with Pretoria and likely the State Department, and came back in and told us to leave or we'd be subject to arrest, and we didn't, and we were arrested. Now, we had no idea what was going to follow, that for the first time perhaps in this country's history, demonstrations with civil disobedience and arrest ran nonstop for a year, the longest nonstop demonstration that that I can recall.
Was it ever hard to get fresh bodies who were willing to sit in and
never
be arrested?
Never hard to get bodies. It was hard to – one had to apportion the bodies in the sense that you had to schedule some of this. We would have on some days 100 arrestees and on other days two. But people came from all over the country. It was a reaffirmation of the promise that this country offers. I would assume roughly that 30% were black and 70% white from all walks, from all classes, from all regions of this country, who were making not only a statement about apartheid, but a statement about ourselves, a statement about what we claim to be, what our Constitution suggests that we should be. It was Americans saying the best about themselves.
How was everybody treated when they were arrested?
I think very properly, in as much as treated as all people should be treated when they are arrested. We were given no special privileges. We were processed and fingerprinted and photographed and locked up and handcuffed and kept overnight and released on our own recognizance the next day. But I think the police carried out their duties as they were supposed to. We really wanted trials. And the failure was in the administration, the Justice Department, elected not to go forward with any trials. I was arrested a total of seven times, and I was not tried once, and I think that was because the administration did not want its policies put on trial before the American public. But the public got the point in any case, and sanctions were passed over the president's veto. Not the kinds of sanctions we need. I mean, we need much stronger sanctions, and we're going to push again to get those. But the real disgrace is that we have in the White House a president that the South African government feels that it can count on. And that's a sad statement for our nation.
The protests in front of the embassy lasted a year. When did you decide to call it off?
We never called it off. We stopped holding it daily. We still have periodic demonstrations at the embassy. But it began to be more difficult to do after the sanctions were passed. It's victory is almost as difficult to manage as defeat, particularly when you don't have full victory, which we didn't. But sanctions gave the impression that we'd come further than we had. We need much tougher sanctions now.
One of the things we've seen happen in the past year is that a lot of American businesses have pulled out of South Africa. And this is something that the disinvestment campaign has been pushing for a long time. Do you think that the pulling out of American businesses is having the effect that people who oppose apartheid hoped that it would?
Well, I think it's important to say first that the sanctions that we have, were they as tough as those imposed on Rhodesia? Were they global? Were they comprehensive to require all businesses to pull out, an end to trade, an end to everything? You would not be able to measure with any accuracy the effects of that on the government in the space of 1 year. Rhodesia, a much smaller economy, withstood global sanctions for nearly a decade before they had no choice but to go to the table to negotiate towards what has become a democratic Rhodesia. The answer to your question, as best we can measure, is that the sanctions have troubled the economy of South Africa. It's in a sad state, and had not the price of gold revived some, it would be in a sadder state. They cannot go on indefinitely, but to make this thing really work, we have to shut all the doors. It means that we have to have sanctions in the UN Security Council. The Congress cannot require constitutionally the president to seek such sanctions. And so we've got to make this an issue in the 88 presidential election campaign. The corporations have begun to come out, but a great deal of that has been sleight of hand. Many of them have followed the so-called Japanese model. They've sold their assets to white buyers in South Africa and continue to market their products to those white purchasers of those assets. So IBM equipment is still there. GM is still there. It's as if they're there, but they're not. They've dealt with their public relations problem, but they've not dealt with their culpability for the crime of apartheid. So we need better legislation, and we need a prohibition on trade. Once we get that, then those corporations won't be able to be there. Also, the real underpinning has not pulled out at all. The computer companies can still be there and supply computers to non-apartheid enforcing agencies. Computers are as fungible as money. If you send them in, they'll find their way to the wrong place. We have no capacity to monitor that. But more importantly, South Africa has no oil. It's a munition of war under South Africa law and cloaked in secrecy. The oil they get comes through American companies, Caltex, Mobil, Exxon. Mobil has the largest refinery, together with Shell, in South Africa. If those companies were to pull out, if we could stop the oil flow, South Africa would grind to a halt.
It seems to me you're working a dual campaign. On the one hand, public campaigns through the kinds of protests that you staged for a year, events that would help you get coverage on the media, but also behind-the-scenes work in Congress that gets less media attention, but is important
to carry out
your goals of getting sanctions.
I think you put your finger right on it. You can't operate on one track unless you're operating effectively on the other. Everybody in Washington knows that unless an issue gets publicity, you're not going to get out of any committee. You're not going to get to the floor, and you're not going to get the majority you want. So you have to create public support for what you're trying to do legislatively. But public support is not an end in itself. We've got to change American policy.
I want to talk about your life a little bit. You went to Harvard Law School. This is actually the first school that you went to that was integrated. You grew up in segregated Richmond, Virginia. Harvard Law School is great training for corporate lawyers. Did you ever go that route or consider going that route instead of getting into political activism?
No. I learned at Harvard a lot. Perhaps most importantly, I learned I didn't want to practice law. I liked law school. a lot better than I like the practice of it. I did it for a year, poverty law in Boston at the Boston Legal Assistance Project, but I absolutely loathed it. It's you can't believe the killing boredom of it, and to play out one's career in the sole society of lawyers is a fate worse than death.
Strong words.
I never thought about it beyond the first year, although I found the law school experience a very stimulating one and a very helpful one in my career. But then an awful lot of people train in law who never intend to practice it.
Now, I have to ask you one question about your brother, who's Max Robinson, who's a news anchor. Has he ever had trouble covering certain stories or reporting on certain stories because you were part of the story?
Well, it was once charged that I had favorable treatment from ABC because he was at ABC. And if anything, it worked in the other direction. At the time that he was there, I got better coverage from the other networks. But after he left, I've gotten more coverage from ABC. I think he and I leaned over backward to make certain that there was no foundation for such a perception. We've only appeared once together on a trip home to where we grew up for a talk on Essence Television. It was the only thing we've ever done on television together.
Is it hard for you to be as close as you'd like to because of the professions that you're in?
No, he has always risked great trouble in his profession with candor, and I'm very proud of him for that. He's never let his work make a prisoner of his convictions, and so it hasn't been all that difficult. I've got enough sense, though, to never ask him to do things I think he shouldn't do, but he would want to do.
I really regret that we've run out of time. I want to thank you very much
for
speaking with us today. My guest has been Randall Robinson. He's the founder and director of the lobbying group TransAfrica, which focuses on African and Caribbean countries, and is one of the principal architects of the anti-apartheid Free South Africa movement in the United States. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with former Speaker of the House, Tip O'Neill, so I hope you can join us. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. This is NPR, National Public Radio. From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, novelist Elmore Leonard describes some of the characters that populate his best-selling novels, criminals, cops, and in his new book, Touch, a former Franciscan friar with miraculous powers. Also, rock and roll historian Ed Ward traces the making of Chuck Berry's hit Maybelline. And book critic John Leonard reviews two new novels, From Rockaway by Jill Eisenstadt and The Rules of Attraction by Bret Easton Ellis. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
I'm Sharon Green in Washington. President Reagan today defended the American attack on an Iranian military ship in the Persian Gulf. During a photo session at the White House, the president said, "We did what was authorized by law." Key congressional leaders also voiced support for the action. Democrat Les Aspin, who has criticized the administration's Gulf policies in the past, said today, "The U.S. behaved exactly right last night." The Pentagon says the Iranian vessel was laying mines in the Gulf when it was fired on by a U.S. helicopter. Reporter Dan Raviv boarded the captured ship today and filed this report.
On the deck, not only nine mines, ominous black spheres about a yard in diameter, each atop a black platform on wheels, which serves as its anchor once the mine is wheeled into the water. Also on deck, a lot of broken glass, bullet holes on deck and in the side of the ship, and shoes scattered about when the 31 crewmen abandoned ship. 26 were captured by the U.S. Navy, 3 confirmed deaths, and 2 Iranian sailors missing. Dan Raviv, aboard the captured vessel, the Rosh, in the Persian Gulf.
The Pentagon said today that an Iranian hovercraft approached the Jarrett while it was towing the Iranian vessel. Officials say the craft ignored radio commands to stay away. The Jarrett fired warning shots and the craft turned away. At the United Nations today, Iran's President Ali Khamenei vowed revenge against the United States for last night's attack. He called the U.S. the arch-Satan and accused Washington of raising tensions in the Gulf region. Khamenei did not say whether Iran would accept a U.N.-sponsored ceasefire in its war with Iraq. Speaking through an interpreter, he repeated Iran's demand that Iraq be named the aggressor in the 7-year-old conflict.
If an aggressor is once punished for its aggression by the international family of nations, we can rest assured that the aggressor instinct that is often found with evil and opportunistic elements will be suppressed for many years to come.
The American delegation walked out on Khamenei during his 80-minute speech to the General Assembly. President Reagan and Costa Rican leader Oscar Arias met today at the White House. Arias is the author of a Central American peace plan endorsed by the leaders of 5 nations in the region. A senior White House official says there was no discussion of the administration's request for new military aid for the Nicaraguan Contras. But Arias told a Capitol Hill news conference that he asked President Reagan to postpone his request until after a November 7th ceasefire deadline called for in the peace accord. Arias said further U.S. aid to the Contras encourages Nicaragua to reject negotiations.
I think the military support to the Contras has been the main excuse for the Sandinistas to do all they have done in the past.
In Nicaragua today, President Daniel Ortega declared a partial and unilateral ceasefire in the war with U.S.-backed Contras. He said the ceasefire would be implemented gradually in areas to be announced in the next few days. Ortega said the eventual goal is a total ceasefire. Harvard Law School professor Lawrence Tribe testified today against the confirmation of Judge Robert Bork to the Supreme Court. Tribe, a constitutional expert, said Bork will probably remain hostile to individual rights, despite Bork's assertions last week that his often controversial views have changed. New York Congressman Mario Biaggi was acquitted today of federal bribery and conspiracy charges, but he was convicted of lesser charges of obstruction of justice, accepting gratuities, and interstate travel violations. On Wall Street today, the market reversed its downward trend to close up a record 75 points at 2,568.05. Trading was heavy. 209 million shares changed hands. Advances led declines 2-1. I'm Sharon Green, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. It's common knowledge that the roots of rock and roll include a blend of country music and the blues. It's also recognized that country music has been influenced by popular black music. But our rock and roll historian Ed Ward says that a lesser-known fact is that black music has also been influenced by country music. That was the case with Chuck Berry's Maybelline and the country song Ida Red.
Anybody who knows rock and roll history knows the remark by Sun Records head Sam Phillips that if he could find a white boy with the colored sound, he could make $1 million. They also know that in 1954 he found that boy, Elvis Presley, whose first record had a blues song, That's All Right Mama, on one side, and a country song, Blue Moon of Kentucky, on the other. But what almost nobody realizes is that exactly a year later, in Chicago, the reverse happened, and the resulting record made rock and roll history just as much as Elvis's did. Charles Edward Anderson Berry, known as Chuck to his friends, learned how to play the guitar so he could meet girls. He admits as much in his autobiography, which will be published in October. He started playing with a little trio, which became very popular in St. Louis. The music played most around St. Louis was country western, he writes, which was usually called hillbilly music. Curiosity provoked me to lay a lot of the country stuff on our predominantly black audience, and some of the clubgoers started whispering, "Who is that black hillbilly at the Cosmo?" After they laughed at me a few times, they began requesting the hillbilly stuff and enjoyed trying to dance to it. "If you ever want to see something that is far out," he continues, "watch a crowd of colored folk, half high, wholeheartedly doing the hoedown, barefooted." Of course, good hoedown dancing needs a good hoedown tune, and Berry had one of those already. It was Ida Red, which had been recorded countless times, most notably by Bob Wills and his Texas Playboys. The song was enjoying a revival in the early 50s at the hands of Oklahoma country singer Jack Guthrie, brother of folk singer Woody Guthrie.
Lights in the parlor, bar in the great, clock on the mantel saying it's getting late, curtains on the window snowy white, the bar is pleasant on a Sunday night. I read, I'm comfortable about it. Picture on the wall, there's a pretty sofa, nice and all. Palm noms taking them, sure I'm right. Somebody else in the parlor tonight.
I'd heard it sung long before when I was a teenager, Berry writes, and thought it was rhythmic and amusing to hear. I'd sung it in the yard gatherings and parties around home when I was first learning to strum the guitar in my high school days. Later in life, at the Cosmo Club, I added my bit to the song and still enjoyed a good response, so I coined it a good one to sing. And when he went to Chicago, looking for a record deal, and took Muddy Waters' advice to seek out Chess Records, Ida Red, which he'd retitled Ida May, was one of the songs he auditioned. Chess thought it was great, but too close to the traditional song to copyright as an original composition, something that was essential if they were going to rip Berry off, as they wound up doing. So he thought of a brand of cosmetics he was using in his hairdressing business, and Maybelline was born.
Maybelline, why can't you be true? Oh, Maybelline, why can't you be true? You done started doing the thing you used to do. As I was motivating over the hill, I saw Maybelline in a coupe de ville. A Cadillac rolling on an open road, nothing I'd run my V8-4. A Cadillac doing about 95, bumper to bumper rolling side to side. Maybelline, why can't you be true? Oh, Maybelline, why can't you be true? You done started back doing the thing you like 400 before we got a hot and wouldn't do no more. Gun
The Cosmo Clubgoers didn't know any of the words to those songs, Barry writes, which gave me a chance to improvise and add comical lines to the lyrics. And finally, he admits it. Maybelline was written from the inspiration that grew out of the country song Ida Red. Of course, the Chess Brothers weren't going to take any chances, and just to make sure the rhythm and blues audience could buy a record they could relate to, they had him record a straight blues, Wee Wee Hours, on the other side.
In the wee wee hours, that's when I think of you. In the wee wee hours, that's when I think of you. You say, but yet I wonder if your love was ever true.
As it turned out, the rhythm and blues audience didn't care much for Chuck Berry, but the newly created rock and roll audience declared him a hero. And my guess is that his synthesis of country and blues, no less than Elvis's, created rock and roll.
Ed Ward is co-author of Rock of Ages, The Rolling Stone History of Rock and Roll. He also writes for the Austin Chronicle. This is Fresh Air. Writer Elmore Leonard had a loyal cult following before he hit it big in 1985 with his 23rd novel, Glitz. That became a bestseller. Bandits, another hit, followed last year. Leonard first wrote Western short stories and novels, two of which, Ombre and 310 to Yuma, were made into movies. But he's best known for writing crime fiction. His new book, Touch, is neither a Western nor a crime novel. Actually, Touch was written 10 years ago, but it languished in a publisher's office until Leonard brought the rights back and took it to another company. Touch takes place in Detroit, Leonard's hometown, and the scene for many of his crime stories. Touch is the story of an ex-seminarian named Juvenal who has mystical healing powers. Each time he performs a healing miracle, he bleeds from stigmata.
The character probably came out of the first movie I ever wrote in 1960, when I was still working at an ad agency on the side. I did a Franciscan brother recruiter for a friend of mine who was producing it for the Franciscans in Chicago, I think it was. That probably influenced me to some extent. I think also the word stigmata that had been in my educational experience with a Catholic education, having the nuns telling us about stigmata, miracles. I think all of that seemed to come together at that time.
Sounds like you even like the sound of the word stigmata.
Yeah. Oh, sure, that's it. I'm sure the way it started.
Did something happen in your life at around that time that led you to write about someone who had a spiritual gift and someone who was uncorruptible?
No, not really, although it was about that time that I got into Alcoholics Anonymous, and there are scenes in the book in an alcohol rehabilitation center, and I did go to one for research.
Well, you wrote Touch the year you gave up drinking, and I think that people who drink or smoke usually think that they'll never write another word without cigarettes or alcohol. Was it a hard year to write?
No. Once I gave up alcohol, there was no problem at all. It's been 10 years, and I haven't had any desire since. I did give up smoking, and I remember that I gave it up for 70 days. And in that 70-day period, I wrote 35 pages. So I started smoking again, and the next 70 days, I did about 250.
Are you smoking now?
Yeah, because I'm starting another book. That's my excuse.
It seems that you used to live something of a double life. You had a job writing advertising copy, but you also were a novelist, and you started your career as a novelist writing Western novels. Did you have any first-hand encounters with the Western kind of life, or did you just like the genre a lot?
I liked Western movies, and that's the reason I picked Westerns as a genre within which to learn how to write. It could have been crime, but a genre with a good market, which Westerns had, that for magazine fiction you could aim at slick magazines, Saturday Evening Post and Collier's, and come down then through Argosy, Adventure, Blue Book, and about a dozen different pulp titles that were still being published then.
Did the genre dry up for novelists at the same time that Western started to disappear from movies and television?
It was because of television that the market dried up for books. And I think it was TV that put the pulp magazines out of business.
Why did you move to crime novels after you gave up Western novels?
Because I would feel more secure within a genre, I suppose, and also because there's a market, and also because then it kind of narrows your sights down in selecting, in thinking up a story. I don't know why in the beginning I had trouble thinking of stories, thinking up situations, and now I see them all around me. I see them all the time. But I didn't get into... My approach to writing crime fiction really isn't from a traditional angle. I didn't come out of the tradition of Chandler and Hammett, the private eye tradition. I approached it more from what's going on today, what's going on in the street.
Did you feel any affinity with the thieves and cons that you write about?
No, I don't feel any affinity with them as thieves or cons, but I do with them as human beings. It's the man who commits a criminal act in a 10-minute period and holding up a liquor store, let's say. Well, all the rest of the day, he's not committing criminal acts. He's trying to decide what he's going to have for breakfast when he gets up, what he's going to wear when he pulls the hold up. He sneezes and he coughs and he wonders if he should write to his mother. And he could very possibly behave like all of us.
Your novels really have a very realistic sense about them. It seems like you must have had to get close to the kinds of characters that you write about in order to really understand them and describe how they speak.
No, not really. It's made up. It's fiction. It's I listen to the rhythm of speech more than I do words. I don't think there'll be in any given book there are more than a half a dozen lines, or say a dozen lines in the whole book that I actually heard someone say. It's all made up, but it's put within the rhythm of the way I hear people speak.
The way you were describing your use of dialogue, where you said the rhythm is really more important to you than the words almost, do you think of everybody as having a certain music to their speech? Is that what you're going after?
Well, some people more than others, of course.
Right.
I think less educated people with a more interesting way of talking, street people with a considerably more interesting way of talking than educated people with more slang expressions, more strange idioms.
I'm just curious, you started your career in advertising writing?
Right.
Do you remember any of the campaigns that you wrote or any of the lines you came up with?
I wrote a lot of Chevrolet truck ads. I wrote passenger car ads, too. It was all print.
Can you remember a slogan?
I'm trying to think of one. There was No, I can't. See, and I was in the wrong business because I should never have been sitting there trying to think of slogans. And the type of writing at that time in the 50s, in the late 50s, for the passenger car anyway, it was kind of a cute style. They wanted you to employ kind of with alliteration and similes and metaphors and things like that, which I've never been much good at.
Do you read ad copy now to see what people are up to?
No, I don't. Although it's funny, my son, who has an advertising agency, my oldest son, asked me if I would help him out last week. There's a chance to use all the adverbs and adjectives that I never use in my prose, see?
You really have weeded your prose of a lot of adjectives and adverbs.
Oh, yeah, I don't believe in them.
Why not?
Well, they just stop. They get in the way. They mess up the rhythm, and they're no good.
In a way, you like to have the characters speak for themselves.
Oh, that's the whole idea. The character, I decide before I write a scene from whose point of view the scene should be written, what the purpose of the scene is, and then let's see what happens. It's point of view is everything to me. It's what keeps me down in the story, within a character that I don't know any more than that character does. The omniscient author who's sitting up above looking at it all, he knows what everybody's thinking. And sometimes he'll change points of view, or too often he'll change points of view in the middle of a scene, and it just thins it out. He's telling too much at once, or it starts to fall apart. It doesn't retain the intensity that you can have by maintaining a single point of view.
Well, Elmore Leonard, I want to thank you very much for talking with us about your writing.
Well, thank you.
Elmore Leonard's new book is titled Touch. This is Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of today's news on All Things Considered. Robert Siegel, who co-hosts the program, is joining us from Washington. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry.
What stories are you following?
We're following events in the Persian Gulf where, again, there was an incident, a U.S. frigate firing at, but I don't think hitting, from what we know so far, an Iranian hovercraft.
What are you doing on the NFL players' strike?
Well, we'll have a report from our business reporter, Barbara Mantell, about some of the economic implications of the football strike. Also, some news from Nicaragua about Daniel Ortega agreeing, apparently, to at least a partial ceasefire in the war between the Sandinista government and the Contras.
Thanks, Robert. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Our book critic John Leonard says there are two young authors who are the literary equivalent of the movie's Brat Pack, Bret Easton Ellis and Jill Eisenstadt. He has a review of their new books, The Rules of Attraction and From Rockaway.
Jill Eisenstadt from Rockaway, New York, and Bret Easton Ellis from Los Angeles, California, both went to Bennington College in Vermont, from which they graduated about a minute and a half ago. Ellis was the first to publish a novel, Less Than Zero, in 1985, and it caused a commotion. A young man from L.A. named Clay goes off to a college in New England called Camden, and when he comes back for the holidays, he and his well-heeled friends drive around in cars a lot, watch MTV a lot, go to parties and clubs a lot, and do drugs and listen to rock and roll and feel lousy all the time. Less Than Zero is a Miami Vice kind of novel, gaudy about nothingness. The Rules of Attraction is Son of Zero. Clay's back at Camden, although we spend most of the novel in the big holes in the tiny heads of Sean and Paul and Lauren and Victor. They never go to class, read a book, or have an idea. They're too busy doing coke and heroin, getting abortions, and committing suicide. Stoned and horny and ungrateful and uncomprehending and ungrammatical, they're incapable of heroism, unselfishness, love, art, politics, even enthusiasm. These kids have apparently felt bad since Pampers. There's one gratuitous moment, though, late in the rules, when Clay at a Camden bacchanalia spots Alex, quote, that nice kid from Rockaway. That's it for nice Alex, who's never mentioned again. perhaps because niceness is inappropriate in postmodernist crybaby fiction, perhaps because Clay knows Alex will be the star in Jill Eisenstadt's superior Camden Bennington novel, From Rockaway, in which a Clay-like character makes his gratuitous guest appearance. Maybe everybody at Camden is writing a novel about everybody else at Camden instead of going to class. Eisenstadt's Alex also goes home for Christmas, to Rockaway, where she's ambivalent. The only member of her high school social set to have escaped to college, Alex is envied by Timmy, the lifeguard who loves her, and by Peg, her wild girl best friend. She doesn't feel particularly enviable, and you wouldn't either if you had to go to college with Clay, Sean, Paul, Lauren, and Victor. But luckily, we don't spend nearly as much time inside the ambivalence of Alex as we do on the boardwalks of blue-collar Rockaway. These kids in dead-end jobs, unlike the Camden zombies, have in some sense earned their alienation, and they are unarticulated. Of course, we'll always find some way to articulate ourselves, if not in speech, then in some other set of signs, in ceremony or in violence. Timmy will lose both Alex and a child drowned in the sea. For this he will be punished at what's called a death keg party, where the lifeguards exorcise the demons of their failure, a ritual of self-destruction as sinister and moving as any Indian myth in structural anthropology. The guardians of life are lost children, each and every one of them. From Rockaway is so much better than The Rules of Attraction because it is so much less self-regarding. It imagines an otherness outside the druggy talking head. Still, I teach children who are exactly the age of the characters in both these novels, and my own children are the same age, too. And the Camden cretins are monstrous strangers to me, as if dreamed up by punishing adults who want the young to be mindless and joyless. And that's odd.
John Leonard writes about television for New York Magazine, and as a columnist for New York Newsday, he reviewed The Rules of Attraction by Bret Easton Ellis and From Rockaway by Jill Eisenstadt. Here's a look at tomorrow's fresh air. On the next Fresh Air, I'll speak with David Harrington, founder and first violinist of the Kronos Quartet, the avant-garde chamber group whose repertoire includes jazz and rock, as well as 20th century classical music. Also, classical music critic Lord Schwartz will survey the recordings of soprano Maria Callas, comparing some of her classic recordings with newly reissued performances. And language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg will discuss the effects of the Minitel, the computer system available to every French household with a telephone. He says it may prove to be the salvation of letter writing. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Ed Dougherty and Lisa Bruton are the production assistants. Our engineer is Ron Barron. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.